welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Sunday, July 24th, 2011. I'm Sam Minter. Yvonne Bo is here. Hello, Yvonne.
Hello. Well, what I wanted to say was congratulations. I saw the picture of the place that you guys are thinking of moving to. It looks lovely.
Well, thank you very much. Here's the thing, and I said some of this in my post. I'd mentioned on this show a while ago that we decided it was finally time to we've been renting for the last 5 years here.
Given the real estate market was probably one of the most brilliant unplanned ideas in history.
Yeah, I mean when we got here, we were still double paying with a house in Florida we didn't rent this house till that sold, but there was lots going on. Oh, and my son Alex is here too, if you hear him.
Yes, we have.
Anyway, it was a smart decision to rent at that time. Let's just put it that way. But we decided that the market had fallen enough, mm-hmm. and our finances were in a position where we could think about it. Mm-hmm. And so we decided it was time to start looking. We did make the decision very early on that even though we could get approved for higher values, our goal is parity with what we're paying to rent right now.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of monthly outlay, I mean, obviously there'll be some costs involved in making a transition, but in terms of monthly costs, we wanted to stay roughly flat, mm-hmm. or maybe even go down a little. And so that involved everything we were looking at had trade-offs, the place that we ended up putting an offer on was. It's a little bit larger and a little bit nicer in terms of the actual house itself than where we're at now, but the neighborhood's not as nice. Yeah, you know? Trade-off. Mm. Mm-hmm. There were others that we were looking at where the neighborhood was okay, but the house was all run down.
Yeah.
And we didn't want to do that. Yeah, there was another place that we looked at that seemed really cool, and a decent-sized place and lots of neat features and lots of neat stuff going on. But then, it turns out it needs about $100,000 of work in order to, fix all the things that the previous owner had done wrong on it.
Ouch. Okay.
No, we're not good. That was off the table, you know? So, anyway, we ended up doing the offer we did. It's been accepted by the seller, but this is a short sale, so the bank has to approve too.
Right.
Because whatever poor sucker bought this place a year and a half ago, prices were still way higher than they are today, and way overpaid for the place. And
really, a year and a half ago, the guy way overpaid on the place.
Yeah.
Just a year and a half.
Just a year and a half ago.
Wow.
I'm hoping that a year and a half from now, we're not saying the same thing about us. But
that guy's
gotta
be kicking his own ass up and down the street. My gosh.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, and apparently he's gone. He's in Florida now.
You came to Seattle. He came over here. Yeah, that's funny.
Apparently it's the bank pre-approved something. So. It should go faster than a normal short sale, but the bank could still say, nah, not enough. We want more. And, so we'll see.
Goy.
Okay.
Anyway, so thank you for your congratulations on that. Hold on, Alex. I'll get you in just a second. Our actual topics for today, mm-hmm. there was an event in Norway that happened a couple days ago that we're going to talk about. The debt limit is still unresolved. macOS Lion came out. And there were some talk about Hulu. So why don't you... I'm gonna help Alex for a second. Why don't you introduce what's going on in Norway, Vaughn, and I'll be right back.
Okay. Well, apparently a... how do I call this guy? A person, okay? Not to be calling names on anybody right now. But that apparently was angry at everything, went into downtown Oslo and first set off a bomb in downtown, near the central area where all the government buildings are, including the Prime Minister's office, et cetera, whatever. A few people were killed. Then he used that diversion, I guess, as the police were going there, to go drive about a couple of hours out to go to a place where the party in power in Norway had a political retreat for youth affiliated to the party. And I guess that this retreat had the reputation of being like the formative, like, cradle of future leaders of the party in Norway, okay? And the guy went there with arm to the teeth and got there and dressed as a police officer and basically started just shooting at the kids there and managed to kill about, in the amount of time that he had, what, like 85, they're saying right now, that he managed to kill at the place?
Something really high like that.
Yeah. I mean, he went to the extreme. Like, he was dressed as a police officer that, you know, some people started running and whatever, and then some kids, like, went, like, were hiding in the forest at some point, and he goes and dressed as a police officer, started calling them out and saying, oh, I'm here, I'm the police, I'm here to help you, drew them out, and then started just freaking shooting them, okay? The guy, the police reached the spot, SWAT team, they finally, like, got him, they arrested him. He's admitted to everything. Apparently, he wrote a manifesto regarding this whole thing, basically saying that he was opposed to the I was reading it. He talked a lot about multiculturalism and how Norway should not accept immigrants and his hatred for Muslims. You know, some basically lunatic right-wing maniac who decided that, you know, his country could not be free if he didn't kill all these people and, like, took a stand and just decided to go out and commit this. I mean, yeah. I mean, it says here, he described him as a gun-loving Norwegian obsessed with what he saw as the threats of multiculturalism and Muslim immigration. That was pretty much the thing about it. You know, I mean, I don't know what. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about some of the stuff, and I mean, we could talk about some of the things that he's been railing around. But I don't know what any thoughts that you have like on this. I mean,
well, I mean that in terms of we'll talk about the multiculturalism stuff in a second. But in terms of the actual event, there's not too much you can say. I mean, this goes back to what you always say about terrorist stuff, at least we always say, which is like, you know, unfortunately, they're always going to happen. You know, there is nothing that you can do in advance that will prevent the one lone guy from going out and doing something damaging. Mm-hmm. At least, you know, without doing something so dramatic and so drastic that it essentially eliminates everybody's freedoms and has all kinds of negative side effects. You know, and we've talked before about how I think we've done that, you know, in the U.S.'s response to 9/11 and the other events over the last decade or so. But same thing here. I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to have, you know, multiple layers of people taking IDs at the beginning of, you know, to get into every camp and checks and blah. And whatever you do with that kind of security perimeter, or, you know, don't let people park in front of the government building, whatever, you know, whatever you do with those kinds of things, whatever kind of perimeter you set up, there's always a target right outside the perimeter. You know, there's just no way you can, you know, take actions that will absolutely, completely protect people from this kind of stuff ever. Fundamentally, you got a guy who decides he wants to go and shoot a bunch of people up, or, you know, decides he wants to, you know, blow up a car somewhere. You know, you can make it harder, but you're not going to make it impossible, and it's going to happen. And if somebody really wants to do it, they're going to do it. You know, so you have to deal with, you know, How do you react to such things when they do happen? How do you deal with them? And of course, you want to make it a climate where hopefully people do it less often, you know, but, the danger in these things seems to almost always be more in the overreaction than it is in the actual event itself.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that, I mean, worries me, obviously, to a country like Norway, which is, one of the things that they were mentioning is one of the few countries in Europe that there was really no significant right-wing anti-immigrant party, okay? Mm. You've had certain of those parties that say, and some of the countries have captured like 5, 10, maybe even 15% of the vote. But in Norway, you didn't have a group like that. And I think that a lot of the people in Norway just felt all of a sudden, I mean, they were like, how in the world could one of us do this? You know? I mean, it's just to them, I mean, it's just, you know, shocking. I mean, I can understand it. I mean, believe it. I mean, I, in a country that has so little violence, and then you have the fact that you have, not a significant group of people advocating this kind of position, the fact that somebody would go to this extreme, I mean, in order to make their point is just, I mean, wow. I mean, I don't know what the reaction is going to be. I don't know. I mean, you think of Sweden and some other countries, for example, they were talking about how Olof Palme, the prime minister of Sweden, was murdered like 20 years ago in broad daylight on the street. And then they had another incident. I can't remember exactly, another shooting like years later. But Sweden is not – I think people still gauge that Sweden did not overreact to the fact that those incidents happened. I don't know if that's going to be the reaction. It may be like, for example, just because it was somebody homegrown and somebody who was the overreaction is not going to be as crazy. I don't think everybody in Norway wants to be looking at every neighbor all of a sudden and like trying to see if they're a right wing lunatic all of a sudden.
Well, you know, and of course, you know, people probably are for the next few weeks going to be looking at what about them? But, you know, that's the kind of paranoia that you have to like, you know, sort of swallow and say, you know, never mind. You know, that's not, going to be helpful in the long run. Anyway, so you wanted to talk a little bit about the sort of fear of multiculturalism that's spreading throughout parts of Europe that perhaps contributed to this event.
Well, you know something? I went today, and because I was reading about this, and then I tried to read, I went and I'm like, okay, what do you think multiculturalism means? Because I went and I started looking this up because I'm like, you know, it's kind of like, you know, when people talk about like bilingual education or multiculturalism, and I'm like, you know, what the heck, you know, what does that mean to you? I mean, when I say if I throw multiculturalism at you, what does it mean to you?
Okay, well, and you're absolutely right. This is something that different people think about entirely different ways, and that probably makes a big difference in the conversation. To me, if I just use the word out of context, and I'm not talking about Europe, I'm not talking anything
else. In general.
I'm just talking about multiculturalism. What I think about in general is the notion that it's okay to respect cultures of various sorts, that you're not jumping up and down saying my particular way of thinking about things is the best way, that you recognize that there are people that believe X and Y and Z and have these traditions or that traditions or whatever. And you're like, oh, okay, cool. The fact that there are all kinds of different traditions going on here actually enriches the culture as a whole. That's my sort of relatively benign definition of multiculturalism. To be clear, you know, things that I don't directly associate with the term that I think a lot of people do, for instance, it is bending over backwards to accommodate everybody's culture, making sure that, you know, if there's one person out there that speaks language X, that we produce documents in language X for them, if they have legal traditions from their home culture, respecting those legal traditions instead of the actual laws on the books, you know, anything that sort of proactively tries to force culture X on people Y, all of those things, you know, are not part of what I mean by the word, but I think they're certainly part of what certain people are scared of.
I think the problem is that people like act like, when you're having, when you're having multiple cultures coexist, I think that one of the things that I see is that the both cultures need to respect each other and need to respect the things about the other culture. I mean, it can't be like, for example, you come into a country like the U.S. and say, for example, okay, so there is, you can't marry more than one wife. It's part of the laws, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and 90% of the people in this country, that's one of the rules. I mean, if you're coming from another country where, that's accepted, but yet in this country it isn't, you know what? I mean, we will probably respect 80, 70, 60, 50, whatever percent of the stuff that you want, but there are some things that you just not, I mean, not going to happen.
Well, to take this to Europe for a little while, one of the things I should have mentioned in my list of things that multiculturalism is not is open, unrestricted immigration. because a lot of people associate it with that as well.
And that has, one has nothing to do with the other. I mean, you could have open and restricted immigration between places, and it doesn't mean that multiculturalism. I think the problem is, like, I see people like, the United States, you see, everybody thinks for some reason that there is, like, you go to Norway, you go to France, you go to Germany, you go to the U.S., like, there's this one culture, that the American culture, that and everybody should just become American, all right? Or German, or something, right? But even if you go to the U.K., the Scots are very different from the English in the South. In this country, people from the Western U.S., people from the Midwest, people from the South, people from the Northeast are very different. Are very different culturally. I was having this discussion with somebody who went and, like, he was telling me a story that he went to a customer visit in New York. Okay, and was had a very argumentative meeting with a customer in New York. Okay, I mean, it was a very, very, it was a very confrontational meeting. And he left that meeting, all, like, so riled up. He got on a plane and he had another meeting with a customer in Ohio. Okay? All right? So he goes to the Ohio meeting with all this New York thing in him and basically almost uses the same type of language or style that he used in New York. While it worked in the meeting in New York, he got to Ohio and the customer was so pissed off they threw him out of the office. Okay?
Nice.
But the point is that even ourselves as a country, you go to Ohio, what's acceptable in Ohio isn't necessarily what's generally accepted in New York. And, talk about making this, everybody needs to conform to the culture. Well, what the hell does that really mean?
Well, I'll tell you, there are a couple things here. And one is, first of all, you're absolutely right. And second of all, these cultural norms, change over time as the population shifts and changes. And, what gets people upset is always that change.
Right.
It's when what was normal and accepted when they were younger is suddenly different now. And people are accepting things that they didn't accept when they were younger, and they're things that they thought were normal and sacrosanct when they were younger that all of a sudden are being questioned. That's what really throws people off. But I'll tell you, on the conform to the culture thing, the one example that I thought was really amusing, and I forget which country it was, like the Netherlands or one of the Scandinavian countries, I forget which, but they started a process where, as part of their immigration procedure, they would show you a video of sort of, normal stuff from that country that you had to accept that stuff was normal and okay.
Mm-hmm.
Let's pretend it was the Netherlands and Amsterdam and all that. So, like, they showed topless women, the sidewalk sex shops in Amsterdam.
Yep.
They showed various other the drugs, various other things that were sort of normal.
Normal stuff in the Netherlands.
And basically saying, look, if you're not okay with this,
You better fucking go home.
Yeah, go home or make yourself okay with it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and I agree, I'm actually okay with that, because that's the reality. That is what, it's like I mentioned, the same thing as, like, with a marriage. I mean, that is the normal thing of the country. I mean, if you're going to be coming over to, but it's the same of, like, us, for example, there's certain things that we have to accept from the immigrants that come in. But like I said, we probably accept 60, 70, 80% of them, but there are some that, for example, you know what? It's just not acceptable. We're not going to do that.
And I think in the case of Europe, I mean, let's be clear. The big fear right now in many of these European countries is immigration from Muslim countries. Yeah. And the worry that this sort of open, liberal European culture is getting squeezed out by more conservative Muslim cultures. And so that's what people are freaking out about in many of these areas. Because there's worries about Sharia law, there's worries about, you know, like France just banned headscarves or whatever, you know, and they're trying to desperately say, you know, look, you know, we want some of these people to come, but we want France to stay France and not, you know, suddenly become, you know, a Muslim nation. I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, I'm like, you know, dude, things change.
Right.
On the other hand, I very much sympathize with the notion of, you know, if I don't want to live in a culture that starts out liberal and open and accepting, and I mean liberal in the small L sense, not the American political sense. Yeah, open and accepting and you know, where you can do a bunch of stuff and, you know, secular in nature. And if I started seeing, like, populations growing rapidly through immigration and through natural growth, that felt like the right thing to do was a much more religious culture, much more restricted, you know, wanted to make laws against X, Y, and Z. You know, you saw the thing with the cartoons, yep. You know, and where various European countries were looking at laws that would say, like, saying something negative about somebody's religion was a punishable crime, you know, I would be very worried about all that kind of stuff myself. I mean,
well, yeah.
So
I mean, well, it impinges on our freedom of speech and infringes on a whole bunch of things. I mean, it's, you know, you've got a whole bunch of things to balance, but you know. Muslims right now is looking up the number. They make up 3.2% of the European Union population.
Which is small.
It is small. I mean, you know, I think that the fervor and the panic about it, is just, you know, way too high considering what we're talking about in real numbers.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess that, you know, somebody, I think one of the things you mentioned, I mean, yes, in the U.S., I mean, you know, we are, I think that because of how the U.S. came to be, certainly far more used to having more immigrants and people of different, from different, you know, of different cultures. So maybe, you know, to us, if we're talking about a group that's 3.2%, nobody would give a crap. You know, I mean, we have the situation with the people, you know, from Latin America, including myself. I mean, we come to the U.S. and, you know, I mean, it's a much larger percentage of the population. But, you know, at the same time...
To be fair here, there are certainly lots of portions of the American public who are fairly anti-immigrant and are fairly paranoid about...
Totally.
You know, and that's been the case throughout our history. I mean...
Throughout history,
you know,
it
was
not
like,
a new thing.
It was the Germans, then it was the Irish, then it was the whatever, Bulls. Then it was the whatever, and now it's like, you know, those damn dirty
Italians,
Mexicans or
my
whatever,
lord,
you know?
Jeez, you know, you think about how intertwined Italian-Americans are into American society, and you think about it that 60 years ago they were looked like the scum of the earth when they moved to the U.S.
Right, and you know, now you've got a lot of that same paranoia. You know, like I said, about Latin America, Mexico, whatever, and people are like, oh my God, they're coming and they're destroying everything and they're taking our jobs and blah blah blah.
And you know, the one thing is that yesterday I'm together with, you know, we had like a huge portion of our family together at the same place. I mean, we had like all my brothers and sisters and plus all my brother-in-law's brothers and sisters and a cousin of mine and everybody, and we had all the children and everybody. We had about 50, 60 people together in one place. And are realizing that, you know what, you look at our – I mean, our children certainly culturally are my nephews, because I don't have a child yet. But, you know, I am working on it. But,
oh, okay.
Okay.
Good luck.
But, so we'll see how that goes. But, you know, so – but one, I mean, it's like, heck, their culture isn't even our culture. Okay?
Right.
It's like – I mean – it is and my parents' culture is different from ours. Okay, I mean, my parents, for the most part, you know, our parents' generation were like my brother-in-laws. They were their parents were born in Cuba. My parents were born in Puerto Rico. Culturally similar but different, but yet their culture was very different. You know, we all grew up for the most part in Puerto Rico, and that culture was very different at the time. It was a period of transition between, like, you know, when, you know, the U.S. and Puerto Rico became far more interrelated than they used to be, and then we almost all of us were educated in the United States in college. And then almost all of us have settled here. I mean, none of us live in Puerto Rico anymore. And I mean, when I say here, I mean the United States. We got like parts of actually, it's kind of interesting why we wound up either in Texas or here in Florida. But, you know, however that may be, you know, we're all here. And the culture of our children is certainly very different. I mean, one of the things about it is that still, I think that almost all of our nephews do speak Spanish. But certainly they don't. They don't speak Spanish as well as my generation does. Okay, you know, and so it's one of those things where you see this merging, and it's a, you know, it's like, you know, there, it's just, it's a, it, you know, that's what I was saying when people talk about multiculturalism, and it's like, it's not like people wind up segregating as time happens, as time progresses, people, you know. Unless, you know, you wind up ghettoizing people, which in certain areas in Europe, it seems like that's one of the things that happens.
Yeah.
Okay. In certain parts of Europe, I'm not saying everywhere, but you see that a lot. And it's like, and that used to happen in the U.S. But if people wind up ghettoized, then they wind up like that they don't integrate into their culture. But like over here, so we've got our elements of our culture together with like something different. And it, honestly, it's just something completely
new,
different from what. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And I mean, in general, I want to be clear. I am very in favor of population mixing and getting the benefits of all the different cultures and coming up with, you know, as you said, over time it hybridizes and you get something that, you know, is new and different and hopefully good.
I think, though,
as a fundamental, though, one of the things I do hold, you know, is that I want the overall direction to be towards being more accepting, more open, more secular.
I agree.
And I do get worried whenever you have movements that are...
radical!
Are radical, more restrictive, more insular. Like, you know, I think that one of the keys is openness to the kind of process you just described, where, you know... You're like, yes, I'm moving to this new country, but I recognize over the next couple generations, you know, my kids and grandkids aren't going to be like me. They're going to be like some sort of hybrid between me and the culture I'm moving into.
Mm-hmm.
But where you do have the I'm going to do everything possible to preserve my existing culture and maybe spread it into this new place. Okay, that's, you know, getting into a trickier area.
Well, let me put it to you this way. Yesterday, and there is a video posted, my wife posted this video last night, so you can watch it on Facebook. Those that have befriended on Facebook. Okay. Myself and my two brothers, yes, we were like, we had a few drinks and we were singing, okay? But we were all three of us singing Jimmy Buffett, okay? Now, we're all three Puerto Ricans. We were singing Jimmy Buffett. Okay,
yes.
So, you know, if you want a picture of like a mixed culture, well, what I don't know what else.
So Yvonne,
that's pretty much it.
So Yvonne, it's about time for a break. Why don't you sing us out?
Oh boy, man, no, not today. I my voice is, I don't know, if a little bit. I'm a little bit scratchy. I shouldn't.
Okay, well, That's it on multiculturalism. And hey, look, we've taken a whole half hour on it. So we'll be back talking about the debt limit and Lion. We might not get to Hulu. Okay, we'll take a break. And since it's been a half hour already, let's make this your poem of the week. We'll be back after this.
This is the Curmudgeon's Corner Poem of the Week, brought to you by No-Tell Motel.
It's your obsession with bears and pregnancy and the plots of your own dreams that bore those around you practically to tears. By Sheila Squillante. It's your obsession with bears and pregnancy and the plots of your own dreams that bore those around you practically to tears, though they are too kind or occupied to say so to your face. It's your reliance on the easy-gotten, the universal, the widely accepted and perfectly explainable in the world that confounds those around you who expect more from someone with so much time on our hands. Have you finished reading that fat book we assigned you about the sparkling dynastic lineage yet? It's your inability to manipulate the steam furnace valve, rusted and out of reach though it may be, that forces your father into saying harsh things to you under the stucco archway as he enters the house from the garage. Yes, it does cut your elbow as you pass. It's your remorseless insistence on free verse that, we're sorry, makes this manuscript unsuitable for publication at this time. It's your preoccupation with corporal rhythms, with sleep and wake cycles, feeding and elimination schedules, whether or not an eye can track an object past the midline of the body, that propels us away from you and back to our smart talk, our dog-eared copy and our notebook on the bus. It's your naive expectation that your father, upon seeing the charred remains of the car in the driveway, its wheels melded to asphalt, the vinyl siding sliding like pudding into a chemical pool, would say something other than, "Look what you did to my house!" It's your penchant for feckless musing that infuriates those around you who have placed wagers. That's good money, cold, hard cash, on whether or not you will finally complete your grieving. Help your husband to melt the photos of your old boyfriend in the microwave and move on. Don't you know how much this has hurt him? Don't you know how much this has hurt all men? It's your absolute refusal to see anything beyond the fact of patchy dry skin and relentless nail growth, beyond milky fluids and all the mundane details, that causes us to call into question your commitment to your art. It's your belief that art is like skin and nails, which is to say, both fluid and relentless, that eliminates you as a serious contender for the part we once thought you were perfectly suited to play.
For more like this, go to notellmotel.org with a new poet each week and a new poem every weekday.
And we are back.
And we're back.
Is everybody just determined to fuck us over?
That's what it looks like. I mean, I'm just like, I'm like getting like really like, you know...
Are you starting to get nervous?
Not really, but I'm starting to get really like, I mean, what? These childish negotiations are really annoying. Okay.
Well, let me ask you one thing on these childish negotiations. Every time I read one of these meetings about like, you know, oh, they met at the White House, it's followed up with the meeting lasted about an hour. I'm like, what the fuck?
And Bonner storms out.
Well, let's not even get to the storming out.
Or somebody stormed out. Okay?
We'll get to that in a second. But I just want to stick with, like, if you're actually at a working meeting where you're trying to figure something complicated out like this, you're talking about you want to be in a fucking room, you know, all day long with a, you know, we're not having dinner till we come to a conclusion here. Kind of thing. Not like we're going to sit around a table with cameras for like 40 minutes and then leave. You know?
I agree. I mean, this is not an easy thing to do.
I mean, I presume there are aides who are having longer meetings all day long.
And well, I think that probably, when they're getting to these meetings has been because there's been a whole bunch of pre-negotiation on a whole bunch of different ideas have been exchanged, and they're trying to see whether they've gotten anywhere or not. And it just seems like every time that they go and they meet, it's like, I'm not budging. I mean, walk out of here. Somebody, and I'm like, you know, and I'm just like, God, I mean, really? I mean, Oh.
Well, and apparently the option that we talked about the other week about, just giving Obama the authority to do it with a congressional override or whatever, blah, 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 that's still potentially on the table. I think that's the backup scenario everybody apparently has in mind.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the coin.
Oh, yeah, I saw a flurry of talk about the Supercoin before our conversation last week, but I haven't seen anything new about it since.
No, I haven't seen, I haven't seen anything about it either, so. But anyway, how much time we got left? What is it? It's the 24th, so yep. It would be, what, next weekend or so, the drop dead date?
Something like that.
So August 2nd, let me see, I was looking at the calendar, so 24th. So we've got like about, 24th. So we got this whole week. So we got until the following Tuesday, okay? I don't know. I still think that they're, they seem close. I mean, it's just, the problem is that when you've bought yourself into a position like the Republicans did, how do you go and, then compromise when your talk has been for, so long not to compromise on something at all?
Well, there's the fundamental... I mean, here are our choices here. Mm. Obama caves and does a deal with no new taxes. The Republicans cave and do a deal with taxes.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans kick it over to the president in a way that politically makes it the president's call so that they don't have to do jack shit.
Right.
And that's it, right? I mean, somebody has to move.
Somebody's got to move.
Well, to be clear, there has been movement on all kinds of other things. The president has agreed to all kinds of cuts he doesn't really want. Although I think he wants some of them. Some of the more liberal elements of his caucus are upset because he's considering things they wish weren't even on the table.
Right.
But the Republicans have sort of agreed that an approach where you don't change tax rates, but you get rid of exemptions and loopholes and things like that is okay. Originally that's not where they were. Because that still increases revenue.
Right.
So there has been some movement on both sides, not a huge amount, but there's still in the end, somebody has to move. I mean, when the decision comes down to, they're not arguing about numbers. They're not arguing about do we cut, $2 billion or $3 billion. They are arguing over fundamentally, does this deal include tax changes? Yes or no?
Yeah.
And the way the way the Republicans have painted the question, they can't argue that set in a way that says, we wanted one and we got two and that's better than five, because they've made it a yes or no question.
Yeah, exactly. That's the problem. I mean, they've made it just an arbitrary binary yes or no question. And that's the thing. It's just, shit. I mean, it's just so childish to box yourself into such a position. But that's what they did. And, that's who they were pandering to. And so now, you're going to sit down at a table to negotiate.
Oh, and
it doesn't matter what the hell you do, you're going to look like an idiot.
I should add the fourth option. I mentioned, the three options I mentioned, give Obama the authority, raise some taxes, don't raise the taxes. The fourth one is, of course, let this happen. Let the default happen.
Right.
And, and frankly, that doesn't end the issue. Let's say that we pass the August 2nd deadline and we start not sending out Social Security checks and we start not paying interest on the debt. Well, guess what? You still have to come to a deal at some point.
Right.
Well, you keep not doing those things.
Right. I mean, it's not like, at some point you still got to come to a deal.
And, I guess everybody's sort of been thinking that, if push came to shove, people will recognize the seriousness of this situation and they will make the deal they have to make. And I think everybody's been sort of hoping that people get to that point, you know, before we actually hit the deadline. You know, and I've heard like multiple people say, you know, well, all we need here is for the market to start panicking and for the Dow to go down a couple thousand points, and then the Republicans will come to their senses.
Fucking cave. But that's what had to happen, like for Congress, you know, in general, like when TARP.
Passed. Yes, but like, you know, what if that doesn't happen? You know, and like, you know, and or forget that. What if it just it happens, but not until after we default and the collapse is happening, and like a week later, people are like, "Oh shit, maybe we should have come to a deal."
Oh, maybe we should have made a deal. Fucking idiots. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I don't know. There are places. There are certainly places. There are many ways that a deal could be made here. The people involved just have to do it.
I agree.
You know? I agree. And but, so the question is, you know, who's going to cave? You know, I mean, they're playing chicken here. The Republicans are hoping that at some point Obama will be like, you know, fuck it. We need to not let the debt limit expire. I'll give the Republicans everything they want. And Obama is and the Democrats are hoping the exact same thing in the opposite direction. Well, you know, somebody's got to fucking blink.
I think here's one thing that I've seen. I mean, I think that both sides every time seem to like sit down, and if you hear some of the back and forth, it's like they get to a point where like they sit down and without the lunatics like talking to them, they're like, yeah, we could close it at $3 trillion. Yeah, we could do this. We can go that. You know, they it seems like they do that. Then they come back out, and then they get yelled at because we can't give in! We can't give in! And then goes and falls apart again.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it seems like.
Well, and the thing is, yeah, they get yelled at, but you got to keep in mind, there's a whole Congress here. The leadership can't make a deal and then say, this will happen. Right. They have to have the votes in their caucus.
I know, they apparently don't have the fucking votes. So, you know...
And there still is a significant part of the House of Representatives whose position is, fuck it, we want the debt limit in place, we don't want to spend more than that, consequences be damned, we're better off having the economy go into a tailspin and not spend more.
Right. Yeah, let's just, you know, fuck everybody. All right, well...
Okay, well, that's the fun and exciting debt limit talk. Let's take another break, and we will be back and talk about macOS Lion for a few minutes. Okay, here's your exciting, exciting break.
Break.
And here we are. So, Lion, I installed it.
I got bad news.
Yes?
I can't install it.
Computer's too old.
Yeah. My MacBook Pro was the first of the Intel-powered MacBooks.
But not 64-bit.
Apparently, no.
Yep.
And
that's so sad, Yvonne. That's so, so sad.
I'm very annoyed at this moment. I was all excited when it came out, and I go to the store, and I go and I click the button, and then it tells me that. And I'm like,
at least it tells you instead of making you download 4 gigs first and then tell.
Right. It told me right off the bat. I mean, it did like, you know. I'm very disappointed.
Well, you know, you got to think at least it's better than letting you do it on a really old computer that can't handle it. And
but I really don't think that that's the issue. I mean, my
it's
computer
support
is...
and keeping support up. Yeah.
But
you know, on the other hand, you know what happened to like the iPhone 3Gs with the latest iPhone operating system.
Yeah, I know. Which is the other thing that I was reading about, the fact that, you know, I still got my 3GS, and then they're talking about a whole bunch of people were you know, talking this week about whether the fact that if the 3GS could really work well with the iOS 5 upgrade.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, the 3Gs, you remember what happened? And I'm like, oh, dear God. I'm like, yeah. Well, here's the thing. I'm planning to go on vacation in September, okay? And because of the trip that we decided on, it is costing a lot more money than I originally thought. Okay, it would, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the thing is that I almost, like, this week after I saw Lion didn't work, I almost fucking bought a new computer right there on the spot. Okay? Which, you know, after I looked at, of course, what I wanted to buy, and I realized that, of course, that would basically wipe out all the money that I was going to use to go on vacation, I went and my wife was like, don't do it! And I'm like, okay, all right, I'll stop.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So, but needless to say, I wanted to get Lion on my computer.
So I'll give you my experiences. And if you hadn't done it anyway, I would actually have told you to wait.
Okay.
You know, it's not bad, but I have had a few issues. And some of them are esoteric. But so let me talk about it a little bit.
Okay.
So I went and installed Lion. First of all, I had a really bad time downloading it, and I'd had a problem with this before on another large Apple download, but I figured out, and it took me a while, I figured out it was a problem on my end, my DSL modem. I switched out the DSL modem to a new one that I'd had sitting around and hadn't done, and everything suddenly worked fine. So it wasn't an Apple problem, it was my network was doing crappy things, and in general, I should say, this fixed a lot of my network problems. They'd given us a new modem a long time ago because we were complaining about various network problems, and I'd put it in, and then there'd been one problem I'd had that was related to running my webcam for my website, mm-hmm. and I couldn't resolve that, so I switched back to the old modem back then because it didn't feel like the new one was doing anything else much better. But I switched back to a new one. Everything else that I've been bitching about seems to be a lot better. Except I still can't fix that webcam issue, but oh well. Anyway, but downloaded the thing, took a few hours, installed the thing, you know, took its time to do that. All of that actually went really smoothly. I didn't have any major install issues, which I've had times before. The first thing is there are a number of changes. And there have been lots of commentary on this. Like, the biggest one that people have talked about, that I've read about, is they completely changed the way scrolling works.
But I heard that you could disable that.
Yes, you can. So, okay. So here's the thing. There are two things that change about scrolling. One is the scroll bars themselves only appear when you're scrolling instead of all the time.
Right.
I tell you, on most things here, when there's a new way of doing things, I've decided to try to give it a week before, like, almost all of the major changes that are somewhat, like, jarring if you've been using the system before, have an option to switch them back to how it was. In all of those cases, I'm trying to say, give it a week. And if, because, like, a lot of people have said online in various places, who've been using the betas and stuff of this, that, you know, the first few days you're using it, it really sucks and you're swearing at your computer and you don't like it, but give it a chance. after about a week or so, you get used to it. And not only do you get used to it, but you're like, oh, I can't believe it wasn't always this way. This is so much better.
So how did it go after your
week? So item number one, scroll bars and them disappearing. This is one that I lasted a day before I had to, I had to switch the item. Now, the next one I'm going to talk about is scroll direction. But this is actually not having the scroll bars visible. And I found that I'm visually looking for those scroll bars all the time. Now, subconsciously, it's not something that I like, oh, I'm going to go look at the scroll bar now. But in order to understand, am I at the top? Am I at the bottom? Is this a big document? Is it a small document? Because, you know, the size of the little scrolly thing changes depending on, you know, what fraction of the document you're looking at. And I realized that that's a cue that I'm always looking for. And when it wasn't there, I was like, what the fuck? What's going on? Also, I noticed that, you know, the new way of scrolling is very much, you know, the gesture based use, you know, you use your fingers and push the document up or down.
Which I will say one thing about that. If you're a previous Mac user, it's driving you crazy. I'm thinking if you're a new person that all of a sudden decided to buy a Mac because you bought an iPad or you bought an iPhone,
you'll be used to it.
Exactly.
So now so they changed the direction too. So by the way, so that if you, because you're pushing the document up or down rather than moving the little thing on the scroll bar up and down. And so it reverses the direction of all scrolling. And I'm still using that and I'm kind of getting used to that. But I found on the scroll bars themselves, more often than I scroll up and down like that, I actually grab the little thingy in the scroll bar and move it up or down when I'm moving a significant distance.
Right.
And if you don't have the scroll bar set to visual, it won't
then
even
the hell will you do that?
It won't even show up. Like I was like moving my mouse over to the edge thinking it would show up then, but no. It only shows up if you start to scroll. So that's the one I lasted only a day. I turned on the thing to keep the scroll bars always visible. But I have left the reverse direction on the scrolling, and I'm trying it, and I'm trying to get used to it and using the gesture for the scrolling. And it's not horrible, and I've been doing it a few days now, and I can certainly believe that I would get used to it before too long. But I'm still, you know, and like we were saying a few weeks ago, I'm very curmudgeonly on this. Like, all of these fucking gestures for, like, use your two fingers for one thing, use three fingers for another thing, swipe this way, swipe that way. You know, my fingers don't want to do all of these things. You know, I'm trying, but it doesn't come naturally, you know? Because there are other neat things, like you put, like, I think it's four fingers swipe together. Maybe it's five. I guess it's five.
A five-finger swipe? What the fuck do you do with a
five-finger
swipe?
There's a five-finger, you sort of bring all five of your fingers together, and it brings up the launch pad. There's something you do with four fingers. It's four fingers swiping up to get you to the new, what did I call it, mission control. Those are interesting. And by the way, mission control is nice. I like that. It's where it groups all your windows and stuff so you can get to them easily. It's better than what they had before with Exposé. The launch pad, it's okay. It's basically bringing the way you find apps on iOS to this. Anyway, I've left the scrolling in place. The other place where they've made a major change that I'm trying to get used to is the mail program. Went from two panels to three panels and has a little preview. For those of you who've used like Outlook, it's kind of organized more like Outlook, and I'm not sure how much I like that, but I'm trying to give it a shot. It also has a more... it has a conversation view that groups all the messages together. Mail had this before. The iPhone has this before. This is another one I didn't last very long. It was completely disrupting my workflow of how I use mail, so I turned that off. Overall, I think it's a positive update. It's got good things. I mentioned I did have a couple issues with it, so let me mention those real quick before before we wrap it up. But one is the backup program I use, Backblaze. It might be a complete coincidence, but I don't think it is. Started giving me an error after Lion. When I did contact support about it, and they said it's like too many files or something or other. They told me to reinstall it and it should be fine, but I'll have to re-back up all my crap, which is annoying because I've got enough crap that that takes months for it to all get uploaded. But it happened right after I switched to Lion, so I'm suspicious that, you know, it's related. And then the other thing is the program that I use to push this podcast out to the internet doesn't work anymore.
What?
It's a program called Podcast Maker, and I guess I'm going to try to find an alternative or something, because what happens is you launch the program and it just sits there. No window ever comes up. It just sits there. The only thing you can do is force quit. So I, of course, found this out as I was ready to push the podcast last time around.
So how did you do it?
I put everything on a thumb drive and went to another Mac that didn't have Lion yet. And okay. I did it from there. But I wasn't expecting that. I opened the program and boom, doesn't work at all. And there's nothing on the website support site about it at all. It looks like it hasn't actually been updated in a year or two, so it may be a dead product. So I have to figure out what I want to do about that going forward. I mean, I could do it. I could do everything it does manually, but it's nice to have a little tool that does it. So I have to look at alternatives. So if anybody out there has any suggestions, please send them my way to have a nice front-end interface for entering all your podcast metadata and publishing out the podcast files, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, that's the only major thing I've had. Overall, it's nice. There are a lot of radical things. For anybody who really cares, there's like a 20-page review on Ars Technica that goes into excruciating detail on every little thing that's different. And there are all kinds of fun things like files saving automatically keeping version history of files for things that enable that functionality. It's not automatic. The developer has to add it. There are all kinds of cool things that it does in terms of, things behind the scenes that make things smoother and faster and not faster, but a little smarter in terms of how it opens and closes applications, all kinds of crap. Overall, I think it's a good release. I have had a couple minor issues. If I hadn't upgraded yet, I'll have to make this decision. My mom is visiting right now, and do I push her to Lion before she leaves in a couple days, or
wait? Not?
Well, here's the thing: if I wait, it's probably waiting a year, or
Will she notice the difference?
No, exactly. I don't know. I'll still have to decide that. Because the problems I have had have been fairly esoteric. My backup solution doing something weird and a obscure podcast program doing something weird. Everything else is basically working exactly as intended. The only things are, where Apple has changed the way you do things, have I gotten used to the new way? Or in some cases, have I gotten so frustrated with the new way that I've already shut it off? And thank you, Apple, by the way, for providing options to switch back. Like, even the mail program has an option to switch back to the old user interface. All good stuff. Good update, couple little issues here and there. But overall, it looks nice. It's a nice plus.
Just to explain one thing, okay, all my Macs are actually, relatively old. I'm actually doing this podcast on a PowerPC Mac, okay, all right?
Wow.
Exactly, okay? So that's the one thing about this. I have this machine that's probably got to be about 6-7 years old, probably, maybe even older. And I have my other MacBook Pro, which I bought in 2006, which is when the Intel MacBooks came out. And the one thing is that because I keep the machines for so long, it's not like I'm going to go and buy just a MacBook Air, okay, with a 256.
You're going to buy a maxed out MacBook Pro with
exactly.
Everything they give you.
Pretty much, because
you're
gonna
max out the memory, max out the hard drive, get
yeah,
the better screen.
Because, right. Yeah. I mean, because I need. I mean, as I'm good. Yeah, I know I'm going to keep this for. I mean, the previous Mac I had, I kept for about the same 5-6 years. And I'm like, I can't just go and buy the cheapest one because my thing is not to buy a new machine every 2 years or something like some people do. They buy a really cheap machine and then 2 years later they're like, well, this thing doesn't anything, whatever. So I, you know. And that's the thing. And so, but I hadn't really allocated budget for this right now. So I'm like a little bit like, so yep. I don't know. I'll wait and see.
Anyway, bottom line advice for any Mac users out there. If you're at all conservative, wait for 5.7.1.
Right.
It'll probably be out in a couple months. They'll fix most of the main issues that anybody has with it. So if you want to be conservative, wait a couple months. Once you see that they've released 5.7.1 instead of 5.7, this is, wait, 5.7? What the fuck am I talking about?
No, it's 10.7.1.
It's 10.7, right? Yeah,
it's
once they released
10.7.
5. What? Anyway.
I mean, my current computer I'm using right now is using 10.5.8. Just put it to you that way.
If you really want to be conservative, wait for 10.7.1. Of course, the really, really conservative people always say wait for the third one, for 10.7.3, because that's really when they get all the bugs out. I would not recommend waiting that long. If you want to be a little bit conservative, wait for 10.7.1. It'll probably be a couple months. But for the most part, if you upgrade right now, you may have a couple minor issues here and there, but it's not going to be disastrous, and it's a good update. So if you get really annoyed by some of the things they've changed, like scroll direction or the interface in the mail program or whatever, there are options to switch it back to how it was.
Right.
So, you know, unless you want to be really conservative for some reason, go ahead and do the update. It's not going to hurt you. It's going to be fine.
All right.
That's it. And that's a show.
That's a show.
So thanks everybody, for joining us for yet another Curmudgeon's Corner. This is what? Email me at abelsmay@abelsmay.com. Questions, comments, thoughts. Tell your friends to listen and tune in next week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.